This is Central Time. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, we talk to a Second Amendment expert about a U.S. Supreme Court case that will decide whether people with domestic violence restraining orders are allowed to own guns. Now, the FDA gave its full approval last week to a new drug that can slow down the early onset of Alzheimer's disease. It's called Leqembi. It's the first new Alzheimer's drug to receive full FDA approval in two decades. Medicare says it will cover 80% of the cost of the drug, which costs as much as $26,000 a year. Also comes with risks of some serious side effects that it can include brain bleeding or swelling. Still, Leqembi is the first FDA-approved drug that shows signs of slowing the progression of Alzheimer's rather than just treating the symptoms. Our next guest researches Alzheimer's and has been watching these developments closely. You could join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about this new Alzheimer's drug? If you or a loved one has been treated for Alzheimer's, what's your experience been like? What has gone well? What still needs to be better? What kind of research would you like to see? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Nate Chin is a geriatrician at the UW-Madison School of Medicine. He serves as medical director and clinical core co-leader for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and as medical director for the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. He also hosts the podcast Dementia Matters. Dr. Chin, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
Last time we talked to you about Leqembi, it wasn't as far along in the approval process. What does this full approval from the FDA mean?
Well, the full approval is a very big deal. It means that not only has this drug been approved to be used in the clinic, that Medicare will also now pay for most of it.
What does Leqembi do? How does it work?
So Leqembi is a monoclonal antibody. And that's a very technical way of saying it is a medication that goes into a person's vein. It is an antibody like one you would make if you had an infection yourself. This antibody goes into your brain and it attaches to this first protein of Alzheimer's disease called amyloid. It stimulates your own body to then attach to this protein, break it down, and clear it from the brain. So it, in essence, removes this first protein of Alzheimer's disease.
At what stage in Alzheimer's would someone use this medication?
Rob, that's one of the most important questions. It is really for earlier in the stage of thinking change and Alzheimer's disease. So people would have a clinical diagnosis of mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia. And the biggest difference between those two is that someone living with dementia has a functional day-to-day impairment. And it could be something like difficulty or unable to manage medications or finances, drive, cook, or clean. But there would be an impairment in that group of functions. And that would define mild stage. Moderate stage is not included in the indications for this drug. And that is someone who also has a basic activity of daily living that's impaired, something like dressing, bathing, or even walking.
That seems like a potential sticking point. How successful are we at catching Alzheimer's in that mild stage when, you know, maybe it seems like something little? It's not going to be the red flag that might even get somebody to the doctor's office.
You know, I would say Wisconsin's really good about continuing the message and raising awareness. And so in our clinics at UW Health, many people come in with mild cognitive impairment or are diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia. And I think that's because of the media and because of the message that's getting out to clinics and the public. There are certainly going to be individuals whose disease has progressed far enough along that we don't feel this medication is going to provide any meaningful benefit. And so those will be harder conversations, but certainly important ones.
Talking to Dr. Nate Chin from the UW-Madison School of Medicine and the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, looking at Leqembi. It's got full FDA approval for, as we just heard, mild stages of Alzheimer's. You could join in at 800-642-1234 if you have questions about this specific medication, other treatment and prevention questions you might have. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Chin, okay, we've got this patient with the diagnosis of mild Alzheimer's. What kind of benefits are we seeing in the testing process from Leqembi?
Well, what the clinical trial showed, and this is what the approval was based on, is that both the person with the disease and the person close to them, that we call them a study participant, they noticed a slowing in their thinking symptoms and their functional changes. And so these are validated questionnaires that were used at certain time points throughout this 18-month study. And so what people should expect is still having symptoms. This is not reversing change. It's not improving overall cognitive or functional ability or thinking ability. But over time, there is a slowing in what we anticipate to be a progressive condition.
How serious are our concerns about side effects with Leqembi?
I think they're very serious. I think it certainly has hit the media a lot. And so the most common side effect actually is an infusion reaction. And so think of lecanemab or Leqembi like chemotherapy. You are going into an infusion center where you're hooked up to an IV line and you're given this medication. And this happens twice a month. And when that happens, sometimes the body can have a response, whether that's fever or nausea or sweating. And so that was a common in about Two th or I'm sorry, one third of participants experienced that. It tended to go away after multiple visits, but that was common. The one I think most people are concerned about is the bleeding, the small bleeds that can happen in a person's brain. Of those that develop it, not everyone has symptoms. And so there's routine monitoring over the course of treatment with MRI scans to see if those things are present. And if so, a decision is going to be made whether or not you continue with the therapy or you stop it. Certainly, those that have symptoms are likely to be the ones that would stop or hold for the time being.
And then there's the financial cost. I mentioned $26,000 a year, but as you mentioned, this full approval means Medicare covers 80% of that cost. Still can be pretty high for people. How worried are you that, people who could benefit from this medication might face a financial barrier?
I think there's a lot of implications of this drug, including cost. So I certainly think that access is a major issue and that cost can be a barrier to it. I also think that healthcare is not necessarily ready as of this moment for this medication. The infrastructure is needed in order to properly do this. And what I mean by that is we need providers and staff and space to provide meaningful diagnosis, mild cognitive impairment, mild stage dementia. We need to go through the process of determining if this protein is present. We need to look for reversible causes. We need to make sure that people are functioning well. And then, of course, there is the infusion centers and making sure that people actually have access to the infusion center as well as the care that's needed afterwards. So it's a big lift for healthcare to be able to do this. We certainly want to be able to do it, but the cost, as well as the cost of all the institutional needs, the infrastructure and the people, is also going to be something that we're going to be facing.
That's an interesting point, Dr. Chin, that I got to say I haven't seen in a lot of the media coverage. What would be a timeline, a realistic timeline to have that infrastructure in place to get this medication to people who might benefit from it?
I mean, that's a really good question. I'm sure every healthcare is asking themselves that. At UW, we've been thinking about this for the past year, and so we have been working slowly to see what it would take and what is the staff, the space, the infusion centers, the care afterwards, the working with radiology, working with the emergency room. What would this look like and what is needed? And I would say there's a big push to have this done sooner rather than later because we want to be able to offer this to those that would most benefit. And so it's probably going to be months before a person or a system would be able to do this on a routine basis. But I think it just reaches a bigger question for the country. What is it that we need to focus on? And certainly, we need to have better ways of diagnosing people, better ways of talking to people about the disease and the course, and still supporting them, regardless of the medication, making sure they're cared for, making sure the families are supported, because this disease is still going to continue even with the medication.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Stella is with us in Sturgeon Bay. Stella, hi.
Hi. My question is, Alzheimer's is but one of many, many kinds of dementia. And in the early stages of dementia, it's extremely difficult to diagnose what type of dementia one has. So my question is, given the severity and the seriousness of the potential side effects, is amyloid the cause of all dementias or of Alzheimer's specifically, and what is the risk of administering this medication and its potential side effects to somebody who has early stage dementia that is not Alzheimer's?
Wow, Stella, a great question. Dr. Chen.
Yeah, that is very thoughtful. I appreciate that question, Stella. First of all, there are many different causes of thinking change, including dementia, and Stella alluded to this. There's vascular disease, Parkinson's disease, Lewy body disease, a different protein called TDP43. And so Alzheimer's is specific to the presence of two proteins, amyloid, the first one, and the second one being tau. Tau's not as specific, but to one of your questions, Stella, amyloid is relatively specific to Alzheimer's disease. So if a person has mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia and they have elevated amyloid levels, we feel fairly confident, or I would say we feel confident that Alzheimer's disease is a part of that process. Now, the complex part of this is there could be other diseases present too. You could also have vascular disease as well as your Alzheimer's, and this drug is not going to address any of those others. So if you end up being diagnosed with mild cognitive impairment or dementia, you would need a test to confirm that you have this protein in your brain. Right now, that would be a lumbar puncture or an amyloid PET scan, and we have yet to determine which is going to be covered by Medicare, but that would be one of two ways. Hopefully, we'll eventually have a blood test, which is certainly going to happen soon, but you'd have to have that protein. And if you don't have that protein, then you still have mild cognitive impairment or mild stage dementia, but there's another cause, one that either has not been identified yet or is about to be identified through a different test. And this drug is not going to be helpful. And no one should be on this medication if they don't have elevated amyloid in their brain.
Thanks a lot for that question, Stella. We're talking to UW Health geriatrician Dr. Nate Chin about Leqembi, a new Alzheimer's drug that received full FDA approval and could slow the progression of the disease and other issues in dementia diagnosis, treatment, maybe prevention. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you been watching the progress of this medication? Are you hopeful it can make a difference in Alzheimer's treatment? What questions do you have either about this specific medication or other things related to treatment and prevention of Alzheimer's and other forms of dementia? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Dr. Nate Chin, geriatrician at UW Health, medical director for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. He's with us today to share what we know about a new Alzheimer's drug called Leqembi. It just received full FDA approval, shows potential for slowing down the progression of the disease for people with mild Alzheimer's. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How has Alzheimer's or another form of dementia impacted your life, the life of a loved one? What questions do you have about the benefits or risks of this new medication? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Dr. Chin, I wanted to ask about the work you're doing at the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. A lot of research on this topic going on here in the state.
Well, the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention Study, the RAP study, is really one of the most internationally well-known. It's one of the longest running for people at risk for developing Alzheimer's disease. And so one of the key things that we need to recognize is that it has taken a while for science to be able to identify this protein, amyloid protein, in the brain of living people. And for the longest time, we were relying on autopsies, people passing away, in order to do this. And so because of studies like RAP and because of participants from this great state willing to come in and be tested, undergo lumbar punctures and PET scans, we've really been at the front in validating and showing that we can actually identify this protein. And once you identify it reliably, then things like these medications can be tested to see if they can actually get in there and remove it. And so really, it's the RAP study in our Alzheimer's Disease Research Center that really pushed forward the science of identifying these proteins and then trying to understand, what about our lifestyle? What about our social determinants of health, our backgrounds, our lived experience? What about those things as they affect these proteins in the brain?
Do we have a sense of, lifestyle changes we can make, or society-wide changes we can make for that matter, that would help at least lower the risk of developing Alzheimer's?
Well, Rob, that's a great question. Kind of loaded too. I would say at the individual level, yes, there's certainly things that we could do right now. If we could focus on our sleep, our culture doesn't tend to favor sleep. And I certainly believe we need 7 to 9 hours of good quality sleep. Being physically active, being mentally active, feeling supported, being social, these are things that are really important. And our science shows has a meaningful impact to thinking ability. It may not necessarily impact this protein of amyloid, but it's certainly important to how our brain performs and certainly important to how we feel overall with our well-being. From a societal level, Rob, we need more access. We need people in underserved, underreached communities. They need to be able to get into safe spaces. They need to be able to exercise. They need to be able to reach healthy foods, the providers that they need. They need to have the things that have not been available that we know can contribute to thinking change, even things like proper education or good education. Those are things that can impact the brain that, as a society, we certainly can invest and should invest our energy into.
I bring up prevention because it seems like treatment is a really hard target. It takes a long time to develop these drugs. They have some, but we don't have miracle cures yet. We've had other medications kind of fall by the wayside. What is it about Alzheimer's that makes, at least so far, that makes treatment so difficult?
Well, I think it's because many different things are likely happening that lead to the development of this first protein of amyloid. There's other things that are happening that lead to the development of the second protein called tau. And there's just other factors within the cells themselves or within the body that are impacting the brain. And so we really understand about 50% of later life changes in the brain. And so the science is really trying to pick up and understand what's happening to the brain, what's causing the things such as Alzheimer's disease or Lewy body disease. And then only once we have a good understanding of that do we bring in interventions of how can we impact this. And so it's taken a long time. And I would say partly it's because we needed the technology to identify the protein, but we needed the energy and the funding from the government to be able to look at a deep level at our brains itself. And certainly we're reaching that point now as far as the NIH funding great research.
Talking to Dr. Nate Chin with the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center, talking about Alzheimer's disease, a new medication, Leqembi, approved, fully approved by the FDA for people at mild stages of the illness. It's still time for you to join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Dr. Chin, as we look at the approval of Leqembi, are you hopeful that, this could point the way toward future treatments, that this might be, not the end of this this thread of research, but could point toward better treatments in the future?
Absolutely, Rob. I really do see this as the beginning of a new time in Alzheimer's disease research and care and therapeutics. I think this drug is one of many to come out in the next few years. I think it is successful at removing amyloid, but we also have to think about other factors in the brain like tau, like insulin levels, like oxidation, inflammation. I think we're going to have multiple therapies often used in combination to treat Alzheimer's in the end. And so I think of this as the beginning of what the time was like with HIV therapy. You start with one, you then build upon that, and eventually you make this disease a chronic disease that people can continue to live well with. And certainly you can in the earlier parts of this. So I think the landscape has changed with this. More research will be needed, and certainly we're at a forefront for that. But I think things will get better going forward.
As Leqembi starts to get out into the market, and as you said, the infrastructure develops to provide it to people, what kind of research then happens to see, okay, now the public is using this outside of these organized trials to see what more we can learn from it?
Well, I think one of the easiest answers to that is we need to know what this medication does in people from other communities. The primary community for these trials were white individuals, mostly from urban cities. And so we really need to know our underrepresented groups, things like people like African Americans, Native Americans, Latino Americans, Hmong Americans. What does it look like in people of color? Is this the same impact? If you have different lifestyle or risk factors, how do those play into the progression of the disease? Even other brain diseases like vascular disease in the brain or Lewy body disease in the brain, when you have multiple, what does it look like when you have therapies like this? And so I think there are a lot more questions than there are answers right now. And so this is going to stem a lot more research with this drug being available to the public.
I want to spend a couple of minutes, Dr. Chin, with some practical advice for people. I think it's probably a common question for individuals as we age or as we watch loved ones age to think, you know, what are the warning signs? What are the signs that I should seek a diagnosis to see if I have some form of dementia? What kind of things should motivate people to get that checked out?
Well, I would say even earlier dementia, what are the warning signs of mild cognitive impairment, the stage beforehand? If people feel like they're having persistent symptoms, whether it is forgetfulness, repeating themselves, losing their train of thought more often, struggling to find words that is persistent and not just periodically, those are things that I would say, talk to the people you trust, ask them, do you notice this? Is it just me or are you seeing it? Then talk to your primary care provider because you can be evaluated with a brief cognitive screen, not a diagnosis, but a screen to see how is your brain performing. And from there, we really do look for reversible causes of your symptoms. Not everything is Alzheimer's disease. And in fact, many things are reversible, like the medications you're on, perhaps they're causing it, or your depression, or your sleep apnea, or your thyroid or vitamin deficiencies. The thing that I think people really need to realize is that there's a lot we can do. This idea that, oh, you know, it's Alzheimer's and we're done, that's changing, not only with this drug, but with what we can do in clinic. If people go in and get evaluated, I think they'll find it more rewarding and less fearful than they initially thought.
Dr. Chin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you for having me, Rob.
That's Dr. Nate Chin, geriatrician at the UW-Madison School of Medicine. He serves as medical director and clinical core co-leader for the Wisconsin Alzheimer's Disease Research Center and medical director for the Wisconsin Registry for Alzheimer's Prevention. You can also catch him on the podcast Dementia Matters. He was with us today to talk us through the potential benefits and risks of a new Alzheimer's drug called Leqembi, which received full FDA approval that came last week. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up, a case at the U.S. Supreme Court next term will determine whether people with domestic violence restraining orders will have the right to own guns. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with a piece of art called The Land of the Freed Up Woman.
The 1970s were the height of the second wave of feminism, when women in the U.S. were advocating for equal rights and opportunities to men. As Molly Honkin tells us, it was during this time that one woman expressed her feminist views by creating art made out of a unique medium, bras.
Artist Marge Engelman has spent much of her life in Wisconsin. The walls of her Madison apartment reflect that time, as they're covered with countless pieces of art.
This is Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star, the Big Bear. Anyway, I'll show you around.
Despite Engelman's own works of art that currently adorn her apartment's walls, she says she wasn't always an artist.
When I was in grade school, a teacher had implied that I did not have artistic ability. So I took that seriously.
Engelman says she never visited art galleries until she was 38, and she definitely didn't make her own art. That changed when she discovered that the University of Wisconsin Extension offered courses in contemporary art.
I found out there was a program in the School of Home Economics, and it was called Related Art. So I registered. I was about 48 years old, so I was a different kind of student.
Through this program, Engelman got her master's degree in art after 2 years. She taught introductory art courses for a few years and was then appointed as the director of outreach at UW-Green Bay. Engelman says around this time, change was taking root.
The feminist movement came along, and I became a flaming feminist because I felt quite a bit of discrimination growing up and also working because women weren't valued as much as men.
Engelman says she was inspired by this moment. It led her to start a child care center on UW-Green Bay's campus for students and faculty. Plus, she was still creating art, including a historical piece she created in 1971 that was inspired by the bra-burning feminists.
But then it was about that time that I got the idea for the Deborah Banner. And I called it the land of the freed up woman.
The banner looks like the American flag, but features stripes made out of red velveteen and 20 white padded bras. It also alters the stars in the corner of the flag by replacing them with foam modeled after birth control pills.
The pill, a contraceptive pill, had just come out, and so I decided I could visualize that in the field of blue.
She created the flag in response to her experiences with discrimination. During her time in administration at UW-Green Bay, Engelman says she was the only woman on staff.
There were things that were said to me and opportunities I didn't have because I was a woman. And I thought people should start thinking about that.
At the age of 96, Engelman is still creating art out of her Wisconsin home.
I have made a sewing center here in the bathroom. So I put my sewing machine here.
Some of her art now relates to more tame themes, like nursery rhymes.
Mary had a little lamb. Its fleece was white as snow.
But like the bra flag, she continues to create pieces that are politically motivated.
Molly Hunkin brought us that story on Marge Engelman's bra flag. The art itself is part of the Wisconsin 101 Project, which tells our state's history through objects. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org. I'm Maureen McCollum.
Now, the U.S. Supreme Court last month agreed to take up a case relating to whether people with domestic violence restraining orders have the right to own guns. The case will land at the Supreme Court in the next term. A federal judge ruled that a 1994 law preventing people with those domestic violence restraining orders goes against, quote, our nation's historical tradition of firearm regulation, end quote. History is at the heart of the case because the Supreme Court ruled in Bruin versus New York that restrictions on guns must be consistent with historical tradition. All this is part of a broader push among conservatives on the court to advance the idea of originalism, a doctrine that argues we have to interpret the Constitution as the founders would have when they were alive. We're talking about this Supreme Court case that will decide whether people with domestic violence restraining orders can be barred from owning guns, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think? Should people with domestic violence restraining orders be allowed to purchase and own firearms? When would it be fair to take away someone's right to own a firearm? What's your reaction to recent U.S. Supreme Court decisions on Second Amendment issues? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Susan Liebel is a professor of political science at St. Joseph's University and an expert on the Second Amendment. Susan, welcome back to the show.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Rob.
All right, a lot of layers here. Let's start with this 1994 law at the center of the case. In a nutshell, what does this federal law do?
It wasn't a nutshell. It was enormous. The Violent Crime Control and Law Enforcement Act of 1994 was just pages and pages of different kinds of measures that were meant to be tough on crime. President Clinton was trying to show that Democrats were tough on crime. And so this included some things like 10,000 new police officers and almost $10 billion in funding for prisons. But it also called for a Violence Against Women Act and tried to find ways, including the creation of the National Domestic Violence Hotline and requiring states to enforce restraining orders in other states, to get at violence against women across the country. There was a Safe Streets Act that was part of it as well. So it was a big omnibus crime law, and it also included these protections for women and a little bit more of a focus on things like battered women's shelters.
The part of the law involving saying, hey, if you have this domestic violence restraining order, this federal law prevents you from owning firearms. That's this case now advancing to the Supreme Court. Can you give us a background on this Texas case that is now headed to the Supreme Court?
Yeah, it's really tough. In 2019, a Texas man had an argument with his girlfriend in a parking lot. Mr. Zaki Rahimi knocked the woman to the ground. And as he dragged her back to his car, she hit her head on the car's dashboard. And later in a telephone call, and I think this is really an important fact, Rahimi threatened the woman that he would shoot her if she told anyone about the assault. Now, a few months later, she did get a domestic violence restraining order against Mr. Rahimi, and that barred him, as you said, under that 1994 law from possessing a gun and warned him that doing so while the order was in effect would be a federal felony. And about a year later, while that order was still in effect, he was a suspect in a series of shootings. And when the police came in and searched his home, pursuant to a warrant, they found a pistol, a rifle, and ammunition with a copy of the restraining order as well. So he was charged with violating the federal ban on the possession of a firearm by anyone who is the subject of a domestic violence restraining order. And he pleaded guilty to that and was sentenced to just over 6 years in prison.
Now, gun laws have changed, or the way the courts view gun laws changed in this Bruin case I mentioned. Can you talk about this standard established by the Supreme Court majority on the historic nature of gun laws and how it applies now to this case making its way through the system and to the Supreme Court?
Of course, Rob. You know, usually these things sound so academic, but this particular case shows how they're not in any way academic. They affect everyday lives across the country, because what happens is the Fifth Circuit does rule on this case. And when the Bruin case comes out, they redo the case with a different answer, which we can get to later. But what the Bruin case said was that rather than asking the question, is there a compelling state interest in regulating guns such that we can ask a gun owner to comply, for example, rules about concealed carry, which was the subject of the Bruin case. And New York State had had a law for 100 years that said you could have concealed carry, but you had to apply for it and have a cause for needing it. What the court said was, we're not going to ask the question, is there a compelling reason? The new question we're going to ask was there a law in either 1791, when the Constitution was passed, or 1868, when another set of framers revised the Constitution after the Civil Law, would one of those two audiences have had a law that is analogous to what New York State has? And if they don't, if they can't find such a law, if the history and tradition of those two time periods, the 18th and 19th century, don't have it, well, then the people of New York State can't pass that law, and so the law that's stood for 100 years in New York was overturned by the Supreme Court.
Now, there's how this clashes with this current case. Domestic violence laws, domestic violence restraining orders, that was not a concept. That wasn't a thing we had, right, in the early days of the Republic. Can you talk about how applying that kind of historic standard to something like domestic violence bring us to where we are?
Yeah, I mean, look, originalism, which is what the justices are using, promises to interrogate the text and be disinterested. It says, like, look, we have this sacred text and we're not imposing our beliefs on it. We're just looking at the past. But I think it's really important for us to remember that this idea of originalism only came about quite recently in the 1980s. And so it's not something that the court has been doing for very long. But this court, the Roberts Court, is very committed to originalism. And the problem with it is that at the time of the founding, 1791, and the revision of the Constitution, in fact, men were very much allowed to beat their wives. In fact, it was their entitlement to be able to coerce them into desired domestic habits, which is a quote from that time period. And the rape of a married woman by a man was not a crime. So, and in fact, the rape of a married woman by a man other than her husband was a property crime of man against man. And this is because in the 18th and 19th centuries, married women and most women had very few rights in the United States. And that means that if we're only looking at analogous laws, we won't find any protecting domestic violence. We'll find the opposite. The history and tradition of the United States until the 1970s is to give men the right, in fact, to coerce their wives by beating them or to rape them. So it's a very tough judicial methodology if you care about violence against women or other groups that were not considered at the time of the two foundings.
We're talking to Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University, looking at a case that will decide whether people under domestic violence restraining orders have the right to bear arms, and changes in gun law interpretation at the Supreme Court that allowed this case to make it to the nation's highest court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're willing to share a story, if you're a survivor of domestic violence or you work with survivors, what do you think of this idea of, you know, banning gun ownership for people with a domestic violence restraining order? What are your thoughts on this case as it heads to the Supreme Court? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Our talk with Susan Liebel, professor of political science at St. Joseph's University, looking at a U.S. Supreme Court case they've decided to take up that will decide whether people under domestic violence restraining orders can be barred from owning firearms. A federal law does just that. It is up for debate now at the court, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Should it be legal to have laws that bar people with domestic violence restraining orders from having guns? Join in at 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller. Jordan is with us in Stevens Point. Jordan, hi.
Good afternoon.
What did you want to bring up, Jordan?
So if I'm understanding the originalist doctrine correctly, wouldn't that mean that today only white male land-owning citizens would be able to vote? But in all of these other aspects of interpreting the Constitution, it is a living document that can keep up with our day and age. Why is it particular to the Second Amendment that we are anchored to the original ratification of the Constitution?
Jordan, thanks for the call. Susan.
It's a great question. So in terms of the vote, there's an explicit change to the Constitution that happens in 1868, which is adding the 15th Amendment, which says that, in fact, the vote is extended to people, not women, but it is extended to all men in the United States. So that's how originalists would get around that. And then they would point to the amendment of the document again to explicitly include women's voting. So voting isn't the example that would be the strongest, but Jordan's idea is there, that, and it is true, that in all things that are not explicitly stated, there seems to be more room for modernity. But what has happened, and this is only since 2008, and I can't overstate that many conservative people have been on the Supreme Court for 200 years, and they didn't write about originalism. Originalism is something that is very new and only dates to the Reagan 80s and attempts to change a methodology that has existed for a long time. So I think there is, or was before 2008, some sort of shared understanding of that. In 2008, people reread what they had agreed upon previously was something about militias, and they say that it is an individual right that cannot be compromised. And that is very new, Jordan. It goes with this radical originalism that is introduced last year in the Bruin case. So we have sort of the start of the originalist Second Amendment in the Heller case in 2008, and then we see it kind of expand in ways that I think nobody would have imagined, insisting that there be a historical analogy for a law.
And briefly, thanks for that call, Jordan. That's something I wanted to dig into a bit more. We have this, as of last year, this historic standard. We have to establish that there was a comparable law in the early days of the Republic. Does that happen with anything but guns right now? Is that something we do with other constitutionally enumerated rights?
Well, it happened with abortion as well. The abortion case followed that exact kind of approach. And I think we are hearing hints of it in cases that involve LGBTQ people, because, in fact, we have a history and tradition of, in fact, disrespect for LGBTQ people in 1791 and 1868, in which often they are criminalized and not judged to be as citizens. But it honestly, Rob, all the other amendments, First Amendment, there are compromises to the First Amendment. You do not have, as Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes put it, the right to cry fire in a crowded theater. And in fact, we restrict people's speech all of the time. We restrict people in many ways. Something has happened with guns in which the narrative has been that guns equal freedom, and that they're more important than, for example, First Amendment rights to speak. So we see, for example, the clash between First Amendment speech rights and guns. If we want to go to a protest and hold up a sign that says, I want X, will you feel the same in that crowd if there are people there with guns? Will it, in fact, affect people's First Amendment rights? Will they be more careful about what they say in the public sphere if they think that everybody in the public sphere has a gun?
Time for one more caller. Liz is with us in Lyons. Liz, hello.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about, Liz?
So in more detail, let's say a police officer has domestic violence. However, they're not holding him accountable, and yet he's still able to carry a gun. That would be my situation. More detail in that, I would want to know how can we make those people accountable and keep them from getting a gun through their job?
Liz, thanks for the call. I'm sorry that you are in that situation. First of all, Susan, Liz says, victim of domestic violence, her husband in law enforcement. I guess it illustrates that these are not just academic court issues, as you said earlier. These are things that affect real people.
No, and Liz, I'm very sorry to hear about your situation. What is encouraging is that Congress in 1994 thought about this and listed situations like this as the reason for creating this rule. And I think the thing that's very important for me to communicate is that the majority opinion in the appeals court below really trivializes the kind of experience that Liz is having. Instead, they see Congress as the threat, not the people with guns who are beating people up in a parking lot and threatening them. Judge Wilson foresees the government stripping speeders or people who don't recycle or who drive an electric vehicle of their right to bear arms. And that is really making fun of what the heart of this case is. None of the domestic violence statistics, and they are horrifying, are in this case. I mean, 20% of female intimate partner homicide victims who had restraining orders were killed within 2 days of the order being issued, and 33 were killed within a month. There is a concurrence in this opinion which talks about restraining orders as tactical devices used in divorce proceedings.
I have to leave it there. Susan Liebel was with us talking about domestic violence and gun rights.